Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Father Daniel, nice to see you.
Chris, great to be seen. Good to see you as well.
You have a big event coming up here Wednesday the 12th.
Yeah, next Wednesday the 12th, we got the Atlanta's Funniest Priests.
So you're one of how many priests?
Well, there's six priests that are part of it, but I don't know that I am part of the funny group. I'm like,
there's how many priests in the Atlanta Archdiocese?
I lost track of the numbers. I think it's close to 250 priests between religious order and diocesan priests that are serving in the
Archdiocese.
That
puts you in the 97.5 percentile of funniest priests if you're one of the sixth.
I don't know how you make that calculation, Chris, but whatever goes on, we hope that it's a great event and that people really enjoy the routines, the comedy routines from the priests that are there.
Well, good luck with that. And let's jump into our first topic of the day, which is former satanic priest Bartolo Longo.
Mm-hmm. Longo.
Longo, yeah. An Italian lawyer who died in 1926 at 85 years old, was canonized by Pope Leo on October the 19th.
Right.
Longo, you say?
Longo.
Not Longo.
Yeah.
Longo first left the Catholic Church after losing his mother early in life.
Mm.
And later ends up rising to a high-ranking priest within the Satanic Church.
Mm-hmm.
He spent more than a year presiding over rituals, including promising himself to the devil.
Mm-hmm. Probably desecrating the Eucharist as well.
Probably. He found his way back to Catholicism and eventually helped found the Pontifical Shrine of the Blessed Virgin Mary of the Rosary of Pompeii.
Mm-hmm.
First question. If you promise yourself to the devil, is there a ritual that you must undergo to undo that promise?
Certainly there would have to be a breaking of the bond, the legal bond that you tied with the devil in that situation. And typically an exorcist or someone who guides you in the spiritual life would help a person through that. I don't know if that's the case in his life, but that would be a normal process that a person would have to go through. Yes. Well,
yeah. So that's my second question is, so there'd be a difference here between practicing Satanism and then, you know, selling your soul to the devil versus being possessed or obsessed or whatever, you know, some kind of a demonic obsession or
sure.
possession, mm-hmm. which would require, right? Well, not necessarily. Let's talk about that. If you are demonically possessed, it's been said that a good confession is greater than an exorcism.
Yes, in absolute, a confession is stronger than an exorcism because it breaks the ties to the attachment to sin, which allows the devil to get a handhold on us. But confession isn't the same thing as an exorcism. They are two different things.
So would it stand to reason then that this fellow, if he made just a good confession, would then be free of his bond with the devil and not needing an exorcism?
Potentially, yes. Definitely, a person can go to confession. They can confess that they have, you know, made a promise to the devil, given themselves over to the devil. They can break that bond in the power of confession. Because remember that confession is a sacrament. Exorcism is a sacramental. The sacraments have a higher qualification because that is the grace of Christ coming. It's instituted by Christ, the grace of Christ coming to us for our salvation, our redemption.
Well, when I read about this, it was really interesting to me because I guess there's been others. There's a third century Saint Cyprian of Antioch,
yep.
who was a legendary sorcerer who converted to Christianity mm-hmm. and
sure.
later became a bishop and a martyr. So it was interesting to me that, you know, in my mind, if you sell your soul to the devil,
there's no hope.
There's no hope.
And that's not the case. There's always hope as long as we're still alive. I studied with a seminarian who had been an atheist and involved in the occult. And he had a conversion. You know, he turned his life back to the Lord. He was Italian, kind of like mm-hmm. our new saint. And he had a similar type of experience. He was from northern Italy. And yeah, people can have conversions. They can really, and especially a person who's been involved in the occult, they've seen that the devil is real. And they've seen how dark and ugly it is. And when they convert and they experience the power and the light of Christ, it gives them a new hope. So as long as we have life, there is hope to convert, to change, and to amend our lives.
And become a saint.
Even to become a saint. Yeah, it's pretty awesome, isn't it, Chris?
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires.
As we all know now, China has a chokehold on the minerals used in making of cars, electronics, and military weapons.
Right.
It has tightened its grip over these so-called rare earths in recent months as a bargaining chip in the trade war with the U.S.
Sure.
So rare earth metals are not rare, but the refining of them is a very environmentally polluting process that China has a near monopoly on.
Mm-hmm.
They control 92% of the refining segment.
Wow. Didn't realize it was that high. Yeah. I knew that they were getting the raw materials, but I didn't know the refining process was the
complex part of it. Well, that's the chokehold. Yeah.
Okay.
They're everywhere. It's just the refining them. So yep. The U.S. used to process these rare earths domestically. So following passage of the National Environmental Policy Act in 1969, the U.S. curbed this and many other environmentally unfriendly processes. So in reality, all they did was export the processes
to other countries,
right? Like smelting and these rare earth refining to China and other countries that have no environmental protections,
right?
Or none like the U.S. does. So given the importance environmentalism has taken on in recent decades in both U.S. politics as well as under the papacy of Pope Francis,
right?
At what point on a moral level does national security usurp environmental stewardship?
Well, I think you could frame the question a little bit different way. If you go back to 1969, the technology that we had in place in order to protect the environment from these smelting processes was less. And I think if the proper incentives are in place, we can clean up the refining processes so there is less detriment to the environment. So I think that creating a consciousness in all of us of caring for the environment, caring for the planet which God has given us, taking that proper stewardship, I think we can find the ways to make these processes less contaminatory for the environment. I think that's the way we should be looking at it, not as a either or.
Well, you can always find a way, but it's at a cost.
There will always be a cost associated to, of course. And I think that's where we can look at it from a regulatory standpoint of how could we build that cost back into those who are making the profits off of the sale of the rare earth materials. These have obviously increased in value in recent years as we're using them for high-end technological advances that are selling at high prices. So those are, why have those industries advanced so much? Because there's a lot of money to be made in them. Okay. So maybe that there should be some regulation in place so that those companies which are making a high profit off of these materials are investing back into cleaner refining processes.
Yeah. I guess what I'm getting at though is more, there's been this awakening to the fact that we are, you know, for many of our, even our military weapons,
sure,
dependent on a adversary,
sure,
for supply. And so it would seem logical that we would suspend these policy acts of 1969, the National Environmental Policy Act.
Sure, or amend them.
Yeah.
Right. I think it makes perfect sense because in all of these matters, the circumstances are changing down throughout history. And so we can't be fixated on something that, you know, was good policy maybe back in 1969, which can be debated whether it was good policy or not. But obviously the circumstances have shifted and we need to be able to shift policy in order to adjust.
Yeah,
well,
what I'm asking though is more like a fine point to the pencil here of it seems like this, what we need to do is forget our environmental stewardship to get out of the monopoly of Chinese refining and then figure out how to make it cleaner afterwards.
Yeah,
because let's say you're facing, you know, an imminent conflict over the very realistic scenario of Taiwan.
Sure.
And the U.S. goes to war. This could happen. I mean, military analysts predict this to happen within the next 2 to 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So something needs to be done now to, you know,
make sure that we're not behind the eight ball. And,
yeah.
Or, you know, and okay, I get your point. I think that, yes, we do need to make sure we're taking care of the policy for the United States to protect itself and get up to speed on these things. At what cost do you destroy the environment in order to do that? I think that there's already more measures in place that we can refine some of these things internally, but you've got to create the industries. But with the advances in technology over the last 60 years, there's got to be definitely better processes in place that we could do that pretty much overnight, but with a cost investment that we'd have to make. I'm not an expert in these things, but these are kind of things that we should be debating and talking about.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about what would be the papal response to if we said we're suspending our environmental restrictions and regulations surrounding rare earth refining, you know, knowing that it's going to be a polluting impact for the period of, say, 5 years to get ourselves, you know, independent. Sure. And then we're going to address. I feel like that there's a case to be made that there's nothing immoral or about that.
Every action that we take has a moral connection to it, because it is our free actions as human beings. So can you suspend a care for the environment in order to do a short term improvement for the defense of the country? There's trade-offs. I think there's some debate. I think you could still put some safeguards in place. You could modify or amend the 1969 legislation in order to keep some safeguards in place, but scale up production.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
The next thing we're going to address is a topic that was brought to us by one of our listeners, which, by the way, we always encourage if folks want to address a topic that we've not talked about or maybe have further amplification on something that we have, to email us at crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
You mean people actually listen to our program, Chris, and send us ideas?
There's one listener who's done so.
Is that your mom? My mom's not listening, I know.
All right, so U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, longtime Democratic senator from Illinois, will decline a humanitarian lifetime achievement award from the Archdiocese of Chicago after a global backlash over his strong pro-abortion views. So
really, it wasn't just over his pro-abortion views. I mean, there's lots of people who have pro-abortion views. It was over this public scandal that the Archdiocese was going to recognize someone who is sustaining positions which are completely contrary to the position of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, well, that's where I'm going. That's the question I want to ask you. So the Archbishop of Chicago, which is where the award was being generated, said that the decision to grant Durbin the award was in recognition of his contribution to unwavering support of immigrants. But for the last 21 years, Durbin has been barred from receiving communion in his hometown diocese of Springfield, Illinois, where he grew up. Back in 2004, his pastor at the time said he could not administer the Eucharist to Durbin because of his abortion stance.
Very clear public stance, yes.
Yeah, in 2023, Catholic Vote gave Durbin a grade of F for his long string of votes that align with abortion, including, for example, voting against a law in 2021 that would require abortionists to provide care for babies who survive abortion. He voted against this law.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, one, should we be barring politicians from, this has come up multiple times over the last, decades. Should we be barring politicians from receiving communion? And should the church be compartmentalizing thorny issues and honoring politicians for work in one area while ignoring a track record in another?
Great questions, Chris. And I think this is it goes back to a conversation I remember having with a bishop and a couple of seminarians when I was a seminarian myself. And I was studying my first year of theology, just studying canon law back in Rome. And I'd come back to the United States and had this dinner with a bishop who was asking the seminarians if he should deny communion to a politician who was had a position which was.
You mean this was like
Catholic
a case
Church.
Study, or he was really asking?
No, this was actually a conversation. That's like the bishop was like a little bit confused. He really didn't know, and he was asking the seminarians, and I was there like a fly on the wall. I wasn't one of the seminarians of this bishop because I'm with the religious order, of course, with the Legionaries of Christ, and I remember kind of being flabbergasted because canon law is really crystal clear. The canon law, I forget the exact canon, I think it's 799 to 801, talks about the conditions under which a person should receive or not receive communion. And obviously, an individual has to examine their conscience. And if they know that they've got a grave sin, they should not go to receive communion. And that's crystal clear. The trickier case is when someone is in public sin, when there is manifest that the person is, like living in concubinage, or someone who is completely contrary to a teaching of the church and they're flamboyant about it. And public officials who have a stated position on issues fall into that category.
Well, and not only just stating what their stance that's contra the church teaching, but advocating
for it.
For it.
That's right. That's right. And so those are conditions that it clearly meet the canons and canon law for denial of communion to someone. Now, the way in which you go about doing that's very important. It's not to make a public stink about it or to shame the person in front of others. That's not the intent. The intent is to bring a person to conversion, because if they're in a position where they're contrary to what the church is teaching, their own soul is in danger, and they're actually drawing others into their own sin. That's the problem. And so the church, in her love for those people, says, don't put yourself into further sin. You know, don't jeopardize your soul, and also to prevent scandal for others.
Right. So is it then a sacrilege for this person to receive communion?
Most certainly it is.
So then is it not incumbent upon the pastor to...
Of course it is. And that's the challenging part.
But why didn't we do that with the controversy surrounding Nancy Pelosi? And I think the Pope weighed in.
Well, some pastors did. This is the challenging part, because a lot of clergy, we tend to be kind of conflict avoidance. We want to make everyone happy. We don't want anyone to feel excluded. And the general feel among the clergy is like, let's not rock the boat. Keep everyone happy. Keep the money coming into the parish. And so that conflict avoidance type of mentality is very prevalent among the clergy. And so when you have a conflictive issue where you need to lay down the law, you need to be clear for the good of the souls that are involved, it's hard for pastors to make that mentality shift into doing what they should be doing. And so some pastors just, they skirt the issue. They run away from it. And they'll go into, I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. I want to be inclusive. The problem is that, you know, St. Augustine and the book of Ezekiel in the Old Testament speak about bad pastors, very, very direct language. You know, and St. Augustine, as priests, we read this every year in the breviary, and St. Augustine talks about those pastors who fail to warn their flock and the grave punishments that they'll receive because of that. You look back in the history of the church, and so many saints have spoken about this grave responsibility of pastors. And it's not easy, because you've got to challenge someone and help them to live according to the gospel and according to teaching of the church. So there is a grave responsibility here. Some pastors flee away from it, but canon law is pretty clear.
The Journal of Hepatology published an article in favor of the process of performing a liver transplant with the organ of a person who had received a lethal assisted suicide jab in Canada.
Whoa, wait a second. Let me make sure I understood this, Chris. You've got an academic article basically saying, let's use organs from euthanized people.
Correct.
Okay.
So the author of the piece writes, quote, "The favorable results justify careful discussion of organ donation with individuals seeking medically assisted suicide, provided core ethical principles of non-maleficence and justice are strictly upheld, along with rigorous safeguards. Liver donation following medically assisted suicide has the potential to expand the donor pool and help meet the growing clinical demand for organs."
Why are you laughing at this,
because
Chris?
It's ridiculous. It was only a matter of time before assisted suicide and organ donation cross paths.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Here it is.
It's crystal clear. If we don't respect the dignity of human life and we start killing people off before their natural death, what's to keep us from harvesting their organs and making money off of it?
Well, and you could have a suicidal patient who, instead of you giving counseling to, you know, avert
right.
the suicide,
you're giving them encouragement.
You
to,
encourage them because they're a potential organ farm.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. And the gall to say that we need to keep ethical boundaries on this is so ridiculous. They've already passed those boundaries when you start entering into the realm of euthanasia. Gosh, what's to stop us from going even further? And, you know, let's raise people to harvest their organs sooner. Let's take children.
Well, that's okay. So that's what the next step would be. It would be to euthanize by organ donation, because the fresher the organ is,
of course,
right?
That already happens.
Efficacious,
Chris.
That it is.
There are some developing countries around the world where children and teenagers they're kidnapped in order to harvest their organs for transplants.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a crime.
It is.
But
it's a horrible international crime.
This is a little more nuanced, where it's the assisted, you know, where it's the choice of suicide.
Right.
You know, where it's just...
Well, and I think the really dangerous part there, as you mentioned, is encouraging people to end their own life with the supposed benefit they're going to bring to other people. That's just manipulation of people who are in a vulnerable place.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Each year, dictionary.com has a word of the year that they declare, and it aims to capture the pivotal moments in language and culture from the prior year. So the word is, like I said, it reflects social trends and global events that define the year.
Right.
So, for example, in the year 2020, the word of the year was pandemic.
Okay.
Any idea what the word of the year for 2025 is?
No clue whatsoever, Chris.
6-7. Any idea what that means?
6-7? I have no idea what that means.
Okay. My kids probably, if they heard this, are going to cringe at me even talking about this.
Yeah.
But it can mean so-so or maybe like it's kind of undefined.
Oh, so it's like on a scale of 1 to 10, 6-7, it's like, okay.
It was in a song. I'm not exactly sure the whole origins of it, but it's mostly like an inside joke. And so it's become particularly annoying to middle school math teachers across the country because anytime an equation comes up with the answer of 6-7 or 67, the whole class erupts in 6-7. So teachers have had to ban the shouting of 6-7. Okay, so other finalists for the word of the year were Gen Z stare.
Okay,
you know what that means?
No. Okay. This is great, Chris. I'm learning all kinds of new words. I love new vocabulary.
Okay, it's a blank expression that you get from the Gen Z
stare.
Right.
Okay.
All right, you know what this one is. The other finalist, trad wife.
Trad wife?
Come
no.
on. Traditional wife.
Traditional wife, but yeah, but what is it referring to?
Well, it refers to what you would think it would mean. The basically what Harrison Butker, you know, was talking about in his speech at Benedictine College. You know, a stay-at-home mom who, you know, thinks that's okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Trad wife. Interesting. Yeah.
All right. So, right. This is some high IQ stuff, right? The language is evolving into.
Well, it's pop culture. I mean, obviously, I'm not working with kids very regularly anymore, so I'm a little bit out of touch with these things.
All right. We're going to test your Gen Z slang knowledge.
Okay.
All right. Riz. What does Riz mean?
Riz. I've heard that one before, but I don't remember what it means.
Okay. I think I'm going to get that same answer to all these, but
you might be surprised. I might get one or two of them.
All right. Riz refers to someone's charm or ability to attract others romantically.
Okay.
All right. What's bussin' mean?
Bussin'. Moving fast?
No, that's used to describe something that's exceptionally good. Often used for describing food. This taco is bussin'.
Okay. Got it.
No cap. What's no cap mean?
No cap? Mean you're not wearing a stocking cap or a baseball cap? I don't know. What's it mean? It
means being honest or truthful.
Okay.
Like, for example, that movie was amazing. No cap.
Okay. Got it.
Okay.
So this just means candid, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. What does sus mean?
Sus? Is it related to sis?
No. It's short for suspicious.
Okay.
I thought you might get that one.
No, sorry.
You got no chance on this next one.
Probably not.
Sigma?
I don't know. Sigma, letter of the Greek alphabet?
No. It's slang for someone who's like lone wolf cool, like someone who plays by their own rules, but who's cool.
A loner.
Yeah.
Lone wolf. Got it. All right. Sigma.
Well, I'm going to give you an F.
Hey, that's the first test I've gotten an F on in a long time.
All right.
Thanks, Chris.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires.
The man accused in the stabbing death of a Nebraska priest in December of 2023 has pled guilty to multiple counts recently.
Mm.
Father Stephen Gutzel died at age 65 after deputies found him with multiple stab wounds at his rectory at St. John the Baptist Catholic Church in Fort Calhoun, Nebraska. So the classic definition of a martyr is one who's violently killed in hatred of the faith and who willingly accepts the death instead of infidelity. So martyrdom therefore includes both the intention of the killer as well as the disposition of the one killed.
That's right.
Given this definition, it would seem that this priest was really just murdered. He's not a martyr. What's your...
I don't know the circumstances of the intention of the guy who killed him, if it was like drug related or if it was a robbery or what was going on. But it would seem that it was, yeah, that at least at first appearances, it would seem to be just a murder.
All right. So then the follow-up naturally is going to be, given the news cycle of recent months, what about Charlie Kirk? Would he be considered a martyr?
That's a great question. I think if you use that same definition of martyrdom, yes, he would be considered a martyr, because the person who was assassinating him precisely because of his beliefs, because of what he was talking about, what he was doing. There was a hatred of his position, of his, which was stemming from his Christian faith. So I think he clearly fits the definition of a martyr, classically understood.
As a martyr in the Catholic Church, he wasn't Catholic.
He wasn't Catholic, no.
So how does the Catholic Church look at that?
The Catholic Church recognizes martyrs in other Christian faiths. So, for example, the martyrs of Uganda, we recognize every year. Some of those martyrs that are in that list that were murdered at the same time, not as Catholic, recognized as Catholic martyrs, there were other young men who were killed at the same time for defying the king, and they were Episcopalian. And so the church does recognize the heroic witness of Christians who have died for their faith who are not Catholic. We had another example, which is the one that took place on the guys from, not Ethiopia, I'm blanking right now, and somewhere in North Africa, Libya or Egypt. They were Coptic martyrs who died on the beach, killed by ISIS soldiers, and they cut off their heads, decapitated. It was caught on video, and they played that out. This was back, 2013, I think. The church recognizes the heroic witness of those men, even though they weren't Catholic. They were Coptic, and one of them was actually Muslim. He chose to die with the Christians because they were his friends, and he would not publicly disavow their faith. And he said, "Today their God is my God," right before they killed him.
So there's a feast day for martyrs.
There's many feast days for martyrs.
But not specific martyrs. Is there a general feast day for martyrs?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Because what I was getting at there would be the only instance then that you would have a feast day for somebody who's sainted but not Catholic.
Yes. So, yeah, the Catholic Church doesn't have the authority to recognize someone who's not Catholic, who's not within the fold of Catholicism, as a martyr, so that they're not recognized as Catholic saints. But there's a true holiness.
Well, they're recognized
there,
as a martyr, but not recognized as a Catholic saint.
Well, the church doesn't go through a process of recognizing them as martyrs, but they are martyrs for the faith.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crossed Wires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.